There have been periods of polarization. 100 years ago, the polarization was as high as now, but it did not result in an actual armed insurrection.
The March to Save America in 2021 has become one of those events that we recognize by its date, January the 6th. Afterwards, we all had a theory about who it was that was marching on the US Capitol and why they were there. And now a team of economists has analysed 40 million phone signals to find out what really fueled January the 6th. So today on Vox Talks Economics, who marched on the Capitol and what the way the 2020 election was reported had to do with it. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. I'm Tim Phillips. If this sounds like your kind of episode, stick around and pass it on to someone who'll find it useful. If you have tried to make sense of the events of January the 6th, you've probably encountered two stories. One, it was a mob manipulated by a demagogue. The other, it was ordinary citizens protecting democracy. And my guest today has used phone data to find out where the protesters actually came from and also why they came. Konstantin Sonin is a professor at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy and one of the world's leading economists studying how information and misinformation shapes politics. Welcome, Konstantin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Konstantin, we need to start this story on November the 3rd, 2020, election night in the US.
It's election night in America, and a nation in crisis is at a crossroads.
We're counting down to the first exit polls and the first results as our coverage begins now.
How close is this election? Remind us.
Okay, American elections are normally close, and this was not like the most closest elections of all time, but it was close enough. What's important is that Americans elect presidents voting by states. Mm-hmm. And it is the states that determine how to count votes. So the system is, for an outsider, is very complex because each state
yes.
has its own procedures, how to collect votes, how many days you could vote before. And this was in the midst of the pandemic. So there were a lot of mail-in votes, and states have different policies how to count these votes. What's important is that early vote and mail vote, they have different partisan composition. So it might be that in some states, a lot of Democrats voted early or sent their ballots by mail, and there were a lot of Republicans who voted on the voting day.
I remember this, actually. I remember watching this, and early on, who was ahead did not represent who actually won in a lot of states.
Right, because, for example, if a state had a lot of Democrats voting early, and then it has provisions that these votes are started to be counted on the day of the vote, then what you see initially, you have like a dump of Republican votes, those who came to the election day, they are reported first, then overnight, you see the Democratic batches of votes being counted. For professionals, they knew this all along. They knew that some states have these huge chunks of early votes to be counted on the election date. So they totally expected these midnight dumps. But for many voters, this was a huge surprise.
Now, the MAGA movement of the Republican Party, who ended up being the losers in the 2020 election, they coined this phrase that you still hear now.
They need to stop the steal tomorrow. Stop the steal. Stop the steal.
Stop the steal. What were they alleging?
First, they were primed to this because a serious part of the MAGA movement is all against a major, like a large conspiracy of the United States government against its ordinary citizens. So miscounting the votes is part of this large conspiracy. So they were primed to believe that there's something sinister is going to happen on the election day. So all these things, like in Pennsylvania, for example, there were a lot of Democrats who voted early. Every professional, including members of the Trump campaign, they of course knew that there will be these million votes counted after midnight in Pennsylvania. But for ordinary voters, this was unexpected. They were primed that there will be some sinister things going on in elections. That's like this continuation of this story that United States government is conspiring against them.
And this story builds over December, and a message goes out to protest this on January the 6th. How many people answer this message? What are they doing? What sort of protest are they doing?
Okay, thousands of people came to Washington to protest against the rigged vote. They did not believe that their beloved President Trump lost to the challenger, Joe Biden. The election was not very particularly close. There were a lot of attempts by the Trump campaign to challenge some outcomes. They were all rebuffed. There was no single legal case which would go forward. All the judges appointed by Republicans, appointed by Democrats, judges appointed by President Trump himself, there had never been any evidence of real fraud. But among the Republicans, there was this growing movement that this was fraud, and this was amplified by the Trump campaign, the outgoing Trump administration, President Trump himself, who was trying to exploit all the ways to stay in power despite losing elections.
And of course, on January the 6th, this was the last possible moment that they had to protest, wasn't it? Because the election result was about to be ratified.
I'm not a legal scholar. I would say that even the importance of this day, January 6th, was sort of a misnomer. The elections, they are decided by state. The state bodies, they certified the election results and sent them to Washington. That Washington, legally on paper, the Congress could not count these votes. And there is a kind of untested legal argument that the sitting vice president could do something with the vote counting. But largely, January 6th was a kind of a symbolic date. It was a date of a symbolic counting of votes. It was not actually a decisive moment. The decisive moment was 2 months before that.
Five years on, President Trump still regularly claims in interviews and speeches that this election was stolen. In May 2025, we spoke to Richard Baldwin about what he calls the president's grievance doctrine, as spelt out in his book, The Great Trade Hack. That is, how this administration's policies are partly driven by revenge and punishment. Subscribe and you can listen to our episode, The Grievance Doctrine. You can also download The Great Trade Hack from CEPR.org.
So this protest at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. on January the 6th, it was a shocking event to watch live as thousands of people marched on the Capitol and proceeded to break into the building. Something that I never thought I would see. I remember thinking, who are these people? Why are they there? I was thinking, did you have the same reaction when you were watching it?
I grew up in the Soviet Union. I've seen people going to the center of the city to protest against fraud. As a kid, I watched the Iranian Revolution. I watched other places around the world. I've never expected to see this in the United States, right?
Yes.
Mob gathering around the Capitol. It's not an unheard of story. This happens in many countries around the world, but typically it's connected to like a real breakdown of democracy. I don't know, revolutionaries bring the mob to attack the government, or people defrauded of their vote come and sometimes do violent uprising. But this was, for a person watching the United States, this was certainly a huge surprise.
Now, to explain this, to try and explain it, to investigate it, you have used mobile phone tracking data, I believe. So how do you obtain this data? And how do you know that if you're tracking a mobile phone, it belongs to a protester, so the information that you're getting from it is useful to you?
Okay, first, we don't know to whom a particular phone belongs, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
It's the phone company that knows this, and there are a lot of legal restrictions for them in sharing the data with the researchers. Data was anonymized many times before it got into researchers' hands. Then we do not see where a particular phone belongs, but we see the origins of the phones that traveled. We know the county or even a small unit inside a county, inside a state from which the phone traveled. Then we could use data patterns of other days' travel to single out, like, the anomalous travel, right? There are people who travel to Washington. It's a major museum destination in the United States. It's a major tourist attraction. There are people who work in District of Columbia. So we used statistical analysis to separate the anomaly travel on January 6th to separate it from all other kind of travel. But of course, we do not know about individual people who traveled or who didn't.
Right. So you have these patterns of travel, which you've managed to separate from, as you say, commuters or, you know, anything like that. You have quite a clean signal on this. What can it possibly tell you and what can it not tell you about the people who are taking part in the protests, the people who we don't know their names, but who are the owners of these phones?
We basically have information about their neighborhoods, about the communities from which they traveled to Washington. We do not know about individual people, but we know about the communities in which these individual people live. Some of our findings, they're pretty straightforward. It's those places which voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's true that all kind of extremist organizations, they played a role. So, for example, if there was a Proud Boys chapter, it's an extremist organization in the United States, then it's increased participation from this community. They did use local Parler. Parler is a social network, a niche social network used by people who are like on the extreme right. They used this network more in those communities in which this network was used more. Again, these communities were overrepresented. Our less straightforward findings are that typically this came from communities that were isolated, and isolated in more than one sense. Politically isolated, small Republican voting community in a Democratic-leaning district.
Uh-huh.
Or think of a community that is less represented on social media than the surrounding communities. These people are isolated in different ways, socially, politically. They feel that they're surrounded by other different people.
I see. And this is what marks them out, because most people who are MAGA supporters, most people who thought that the election had been stolen from them, they didn't take part in those protests, even though thousands did. And you're saying that this type of protester was overrepresented in that group.
Right. But we also noted in those states which President Trump, the sitting president, narrowly lost, and in those counties in which there was Trump to Biden swing in the election night voter tally, so where the reported number of the collected votes was for Trump going into the evening on the election day, and then in the morning it was Biden winning because of these mail-in votes, because of the early votes counted this way, there was a disproportional representation from these places.
I see.
We cannot know what is on people's minds, but it seems that there were people who were concerned about votes still, easily explained by professionals, but they took this as a visible sign of fraud.
If we were to go inside the mind of someone who was taking part, for these reasons, who was taking part in the protest, then perhaps they felt isolated politically, as you say, they're surrounded by areas that don't think politically the same as their community does. They went to bed thinking that they'd won the election. They woke up and found that they hadn't. This has given them a reason why they think they should protest.
Yeah. Again, for an economist, it's tempting to go into the psychology speculation about yes. what happens in people's mind. I told you what we saw in the data.
Yeah.
And basically, that's the way we interpret this. But at least what we're saying that this was just a totally uninformed mob. These were people who paid attention to what is happening. And they saw signs that people could interpret as a sign of electoral fraud. And this has implications because Democrats, for many campaigns after that, they're trying to raise people to defend democracy. And it does not easily work, as the past elections demonstrated, this cry to defend democracy. And perhaps one reason for this is that the people on the other side, a lot of them genuinely believe that they do defend democracy. They're perhaps mistaken about this, but they believe that they're defending democracy.
We are in a very charged political environment, a very polarized political environment at the moment. But people have always had strong opinions, and many people have always thought that they lost elections unfairly. This is not a new charge. Is there something different about this event?
There is obviously something different about this event, because watching American elections like for, I don't know, centuries, there have been periods of polarization. 100 years ago, the polarization was as high as now. There were strong feelings. There were very divided polities, but it did not result in an actual armed insurrection. There is something special about this event. It's not just an outcome of the vote and then a protest. This made the United States look like, in my childhood, we would use the word third world country, but as if this was a country with not a mature democracy and a history of 200 years of competitive elections.
Many of us have paid much more attention to how the US runs its elections now, this reporting by states, this idea that the results are being reported minute by minute, while people are still voting in some cases, can be surprising. This is a very particular story to the US. Is this instructive about how other democratic protests are happening around the world?
It seems to me that we need to have electoral systems which are relatively easy to discern, that are not only good for academics, but also easy to explain to ordinary voters, because eventually it's the ordinary voters who either believe that electoral system works or do not believe that the electoral system works. And if this system is overly complicated, then perhaps it's a problem, because people could take the complexity of the system to mean a sign of electoral fraud.
Asking what we should do about this, well, that causes many reactions. We think about the right for democratic protest, but then we think about the respecting of the democratic process. Is it easy to find lessons, perhaps for US democracy, the next time that there is a US presidential election? Would there be easy suggestions about how we can avoid problems like this?
Both Democrats and Republicans, although in slightly different ways, they are set to better describe the electoral procedures, because there were a lot of, I don't know, one-time patches because of the pandemic. The government was still encouraging people not to do social gatherings, so there were all kind of patches that different states did to let people vote. So since then, there are attempts to put more structure on this. Also, the United States Congress passed a couple of laws that make the abuse of the procedure at the federal level, when the votes are aggregated, at least slightly less easy than it was back 5-6 years ago. Right? So now the whole process of gathering votes and the Congress voting on accepting these votes is simplified and made more institutionalized than it was in 2020.
We wait to see what the outcome of this is and whether it was a one-off or whether there are deeper problems for how democracy works in the US and in other places as well. Constantine, thank you very much for talking about it today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The paper is called Isolation and Insurrection: How Partisanship and Political Geography Fueled January the 6th, 2021. Authors Constantine Sonin, David Van Dyke, and Austin Wright.
Vox Talks Economics is a Torg Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week, the Bank of England's capital mistake.